This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're really happy to have Miriam Herzlag of The Times of Israel to join us again. She's been with us a few times, and especially given the fact that we're just ahead of the beginning session at the International Court of Justice hearing, but you'll be hearing this interview at the halfway mark of that hearing. We didn't want to go through the contents of the hearing itself, because obviously we haven't heard it yet. But to introduce Miriam, she's the Times of Israel opinion and blogs editor, and she was a reporter and anchor for Israel's English radio and TV news. She spent several years in Hong Kong, lovely city, where she was the founding editor of a business website and later ran training and documentation departments at Given Imaging. And now, of course, she's living in Jerusalem. We're speaking just ahead of the beginning of the International Court of Justice's hearing, in which South Africa has contended that Israel has carried out genocidal actions against the population of Gaza. And as I said right at the beginning, rather than ask her opinion of the petition itself or the way in which the hearings have transpired, since of course we can't time travel, we wanted to talk a little bit about the way in which these hearings on the horizon now, how is it affecting Israelis, and what do they think? And so none better perhaps than to ask Miriam Herzlag yet again to talk with us about things Israel and things on the mind of Israelis. And with that too long introduction, really.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brooks. So you're asking how Israelis are seeing this this process as it begins this week. So the accusation of genocide, similar to the accusation actually of apartheid, is dismissed by most Israelis as somewhere between absurd and plain, just downright evil. Israelis, I think, inclined already to feel isolated in the world, and this really adds to that sense of feeling really gaslighted about our experiences in what happened on October 7th and subsequently what Israel did in response.
If that's the case, if the hearing goes forward, as several people I've talked to feel it will, with ultimately an indictment, although it will take some months, perhaps even years, before the indictment is issued, the International Court of Justice is not known for its speedy delivery of opinions. That's going to further estrange Israelis from the international community, I would suspect, and may have some deleterious effects on its relationship with the United States.
Yes, indeed. And actually not in the long run, but in the medium or short run, there's great concern here that the court will issue an interim decision that requires Israel to enter into a ceasefire. This would be then taken up by the United Nations General Assembly and turned into policy, at which point the United States would have its back up against the wall in terms of deciding whether to continue its support for Israel. I say that with some hesitation. We can discuss that as well, but it would have to then choose whether to stand in violation of an international ruling at the highest level, or say to Israel, we are no longer able to stand by your side and support you in this war. And that's of grave concern for Israelis in general, for the commentators that we're hearing, the military people, the political level as well. Obviously, Israel has benefited from tremendous amount of support from the U.S. and from our European allies in this war, which Israelis, by and large, even the more left of the spectrum, consider to be justified. There is criticism and will be of exactly how the war is being prosecuted. But the notion that this isn't a just war and that this is in some sense, in any sense, a genocidal war is not at all embraced by any, you know, certainly not by the mainstream Israelis. And I think even, you know, in the fairly far left of Israel, not after what happened on October 7th.
Part of the problem for that U.S.-Israeli relationship, of course, is that all of this is taking place. This particular set of hearing is coming just as the American election, its quadrennial presidential and other offices election, really kicks off on Monday with the first set of caucus votes in snowy Iowa. To that extent, then, Israel is something of a political issue, even if support in U.S. Congress remains strong. There are people in Congress who feel that enough aid is enough. Let Israel, let Ukraine float your own boats, fellas.
Yeah, and it's been made very clear to us that this is a crucially important issue for the United States politically and geopolitically. You know, Antony Blinken, I think, is here right now as we're speaking this week, I believe on his seventh visit since the beginning, since October 7th, and other senior U.S. officials have been in and out, both top brass from the army as well as political figures and diplomatic figures. So this is very much considered, you know, it's of great importance. I mean, both because it's got regional implications. We are not only in a battle between a tiny enclave to our south. We have a multi-front situation that involves Iran. So for very pragmatic reasons, the U.S. has concerns. It sent aircraft carriers to our region to make an important statement. But of course, also politically, we know that President Biden has been a staunch supporter. He came out very quickly and sent a message of great comfort and sympathy. And he's long known as sort of as basically a Zionist and a supporter, a great supporter of Israel throughout his political career. And we know that that is not something that necessarily characterizes the whole Democratic Party, and in particularly the younger members of the Democratic Party. And this could be become a problem for him if voters decide perhaps to stay home rather than come out to vote based on this issue. I mean, we don't know to the extent to which U.S. voters consider the Middle East, U.S. Middle East policy to be the key voting issue. I would imagine that that's relatively small, the economy being number one, two, and three, but it's still a factor in a close race.
Well, immigration's right up there in the mix right now as well, the border and its control or lack thereof. We're speaking with Miriam Herzlag of the Times of Israel. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, on The Deep Dive.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest today is Miriam Herzlag from Tel Aviv. She's the editor, the opinion and blogs editor for The Times of Israel, and we've talked with her before. We're hoping we can get a temperature reading, a textural reading of Israeli opinion about the way circumstances are happening now that the International Court of Justice is just about to begin its second day of hearings on a petition from South Africa against Israel and its conduct of the war in Gaza. We're pre-recording this session, so we're obviously not going to be able to comment on the way in which South Africa addressed the justices. You will undoubtedly, as an audience, be following that closely. Just before we took our break, You mentioned about the broader regional context for the fighting in Gaza, and I wanted to then go back to that just a bit. When you say that, the fighting, the military circumstances, the ongoing circumstances seemingly without end, many people think that this has really been a major blow to the Israeli effort to build its relationship further with Arab neighbors following the, if you go back far enough in history, the Camp David Accord, the Oslo Accord, the Abraham Accords, and the temptation or the tantalizing possibility that there would be a rapprochement with Saudi Arabia. Given the current circumstances, that seems increasingly unlikely, receding further and further into the distance.
Yes, it definitely casts a question. I think Israelis are focused on our immediate concerns and trauma and worries. And it is not, if you judge our concerns based on the lineup of the nightly news, we're all news junkies here to begin with. And of course, we're all watching about five times the amount of news that we normally consume. The issue rarely is coming up these days. So is it the first concern of Israelis? But one thing it's there, the worry that we were on a roll, that we had this momentum for peace that was leading inexorably to rapprochement or peace with Saudi Arabia after solidifying ties with the UAE, importantly, and Morocco and others. I will say that we've received some indication from the Saudis that they are not ready to, turn the table over and leave and walk out of the room. They're not saying that they're going to step in, for example, neither the Saudis nor the UAE, and fund the Palestinian Authority, while Israel withholds funds, and start, pumping money into a system that is currently being very, very stressed and fomenting violence as a result of what's going on in the West Bank. I'm not even talking about Gaza. They rejected that, but on the other hand, they have not walked out of the room. One reason for that might be that we share the common enemy of Iran. And while we talk about this situation, it's been talked about as a seven-front war. It all leads through Iran, and that has always been one of the reasons, at least Israelis understand it that way, that Saudi Arabia might consider it beneficial to have a relationship with Israel. So hope on that score is not lost, but it is receding. So I would say that.
That provokes me to a question. The South Africans issued their petition. They were not joined with by a broad range of Middle Eastern and Arab nations, interestingly. I mean, the Saudis did not jump on board, countries that the Israelis have diplomatic ties with, although Malaysia did. What do you think about that? And second part of that question is, why do you think the South Africans took the action they did in the first place?
Well, South Africa has a history of identifying with the Palestinians and their cause, and has been aligned with the Palestinian messaging and for years. So in that sense, it's not surprising. The Palestinians themselves don't have the standing to be able to bring such a petition to the court. So they went to their most reliable ally, and South Africa was, very happy to bring this. I think that's just simply consistent with South African policy. We know that South Africa, when did South Africa call for a ceasefire in this? It was
early.
Yes, so it was October 7th. In other words,
early. Yeah.
Yeah, it was the very day that Israelis were being massacred. Israelis were literally still being massacred when South Africa called on Israel to stop attacking. We were in bomb shelters, and the travesties that were happening that we are still in shock over, unimaginable atrocities were being committed at that time. And that's what South Africa chose to do. So this is consistent. South Africa's foreign minister called Ismail Haniya and congratulated him, although that's been clarified and hedged.
There's some dispute about the congratulatory nature of the call.
Yes. And still, perhaps the person responsible for perpetrating mass rape and the burning of bodies and the dismemberment and the taking of hostages isn't the person you want to call for a friendly chat several weeks after it's clear that that's what happened. So I think this is consistent. Obviously, I think it's unfortunate. We'll have to see. I should say that the petition was given fuel by Israelis in power here who spoke in ways that are quotably terrible. And in fact, the things that were said about Palestinians, about Gaza, about Hamas, following this were extremely inflammatory, and some of the people may have been speaking in the moment, and others really feel this way because we have some extreme, radically right-wing figures in our government who consistently have spoken this way. So one, and they're quoted at length in the petition that South Africa brought.
I mean, if you're aiming at in the direction of settling differences or tamping down conflict, I suspect one of the things you don't do is call your enemy or your antagonist a human animal. Probably doesn't lend much to the discussion.
Well, I don't think we were having a discussion at that time.
I mean, discussion in the broad sense of the word.
Yeah, I mean, looks, I hate to keep going back because for one thing, it's traumatizing to even think about these acts and these images that we have. And I think that there's a reason, you can't say bombastic without bombs. It's like we become bombastic when we are in a state of shock, in a state of trauma. And I will say, I have to say, apart from the politicians, some of who are, I think, obligated to speak responsibly and understand how they sound, not just to the local audience, but beyond, all of us, I think, found ourselves speaking in ways that we weren't used to hearing ourselves speak. It was really, I think, a lesson in what happens when you are brought into a situation where you're terrified. You're terrified. You're horrified. You're in mourning and you're in trauma. That does not excuse particularly the figures who continued to speak this way. And I think for Israelis, it's a reckoning. There's going to be a political reckoning after this. And on that list is going to be those who seem to feel they can say crazy things without having any deleterious impact on Israel's place in the world. And I think those people will, find that they pay a political price for it. They're not the only ones quoted, but.
I'm going to have to stop here. We have to take another station break. We're mandated to do these things. We'll get back to this point in a minute. This is The Deep Dive.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. Guest today, Miriam Hirschlag of The Times of Israel. And just before our last break, we were talking about the way in which language itself began to be traumatized and the way it was used and the way people were expressing their responses to events. And at the same time, she was adding that there'll be a political price to politicians who carried out such verbal, well, appalling messages. And the reckoning day is coming at some point. And of course, the question is, when is that some point? That leads me, obviously, to the question of what is your guess? What is your sentiment as you take the pulse of things? Your country's public opinion toward the progress of the war beyond the objective of punishing Hamas and recovering the hostages that had been taken. Are people beginning to wonder if this has been worth the effort?
I'm not sure about the question. I want to understand what you're asking. That you, by this, you mean the massive bombardment of Gaza and the deployment of hundreds of thousands of regular and reserve duty soldiers, including the high deaths. I assume that's what you're referring to.
Plus the cost to any larger efforts at peace and the standing of Israelis in internationally, and the fact that the country is being brought before the International Court of Justice in the process. But do people still feel that this has been worth the effort in its entirety and with the costs that have come?
There's broad support for the two main goals of this war. One is to bring back the hostages, of which some 130, not all of them alive, remain in Hamas hands. And the other to ensure that Hamas can no longer target Israel with rockets and is no longer essentially a functional power in Gaza. Those are the two aims of the war. There is nobody who I am hearing saying, let's just leave the hostages there to rot in the tunnels of Gaza. Nobody. And there is very little appetite to say, you know what, these Gaza guys, these Hamas people, you know, aren't so bad. Let's try and talk with them. I mean, they made it very clear that their goal was the destruction of Israel. And as we pursue this war, we find factories for precision cruise missiles, and just a massive war machine, a city underground, heavily funded and armed by Iran and its proxies. So there is the sense that as awful as it is, and war is awful and just, you know, unpredictable and terrible things happen. Just yesterday, we had a 24-hour period in which nine soldiers were killed, six in one spot because of they were about to blow up a tunnel and something went wrong. A spark ignited the fuse that they were working in, to put it in probably very crude and simple terms, and they were blown up. And you can talk about, I understand that we talk about numbers, and the Palestinian numbers are very grim. And yet for Israelis, seeing these young men on their faces, looking out at us from the daily paper and the daily news, this is it's shredding our hearts. So nobody thinks that this is something, nobody should be confused that Israel isn't feeling like it's losing the best of the best people in this war. And we're talking about, relatives of high officials all the way down, to every level of Israel's socioeconomic classes are involved. Palestinian Israeli soldiers are fighting in this war against Hamas, and being killed. The understanding is that this is a horrific price to pay. But I don't know if you want to say it's worth it. I think people are saying there's no choice. And it's unfortunate that the outcome is, you know, whatever the world says about this, or that it's horrible, the death count, but that everyone, not everyone, but, you know, I would say by and large, there is tremendous support to try and finish this war and finish off Hamas. There's always a problem because, and there are a lot of people saying, wait, where do we know? How do we know it's done? And can we trust our political leaders to know when to stop? And there's even questions, grave questions, about whether the initial level of bombing was the right approach and was the ethical approach. But in the midst of this basically just war, those questions will be dealt with at some point. And Israelis are not known for accepting what they're told. And we're not known for not being the most argumentative of populations. We were, up until October 6th, in a deep and painful fight with each other. And the way that at least the people, if not the leaders, have come together, I think, is an indication that this isn't a debate. It's not a conversation. It's a sense that this is an existential war, partly because Hamas has made clear in its rhetoric and its actions about exactly what its aims are, and because Israelis understand that this isn't just Hamas. This is a regional event with regional implications, and that leaving Hamas in power would signal to our Arab allies that they picked the wrong horse, and that includes Egypt. So, you know, they may condemn us in public, but I don't think that either Saudi Arabia or Egypt or others really particularly want to see a decimated Gaza where Hamas emerges from the dust, waving their, you know, their victory flag.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest today is Marion Hirschleit, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and we're speaking with Marion Hirschleit from the Times of Israel. She's in Israel now in Tel Aviv, and there have been no sirens other than a truck horn fire conversation. So I guess we count that as a victory of sorts.
I think it's important, and I suppose if your reference is Vietnam, but you can take pretty much any war that people kind of reference outside of Israel. And I think it's a useful conversation to compare. Israeli political leadership has not had to sell this war to the Israeli citizens. Israeli citizens actually entered the war before the government did, right? Because we had an attack into our southern border, or our border with Gaza, in which cities and communities were invaded by thousands of Hamas terrorists. With maps that were going to take them all the way into the interior of the country. The army wasn't there. The government wasn't there. People jumped into their uniforms, grabbed their guns if they had them, and went to fight this war. This is, you know, as straightforward as you can get. It was, you know, people inside the country who were being killed. I'm sure the listeners are very attuned to who the victims were. They included peace activists. This wasn't an attack on politically controversial communities. So at the same time that they did that, barrages of missiles were aimed at the center of the country, throughout the country, obviously the south, but also the center. And the north was attacked as well by Hezbollah in sympathy with the Palestinians to try and create a two-front war. Israelis don't need to be, you know, talked into having to go. The number of soldiers that got onto planes from wherever they were in the world, you know, guys who were on their post-army hike or people who were living abroad and, you know, just clamored to the airports to get on to defend their country and to defend their families. That's, you know, that I think tells you something about how this war differs from a war being waged, you know, halfway around the world, where you have to try and explain the difference between the North Vietnam and South Vietnam. So this is, it's very, very, you know, personal and clear and immediate for Israelis. I live a 56-minute drive from Gaza. I'm in the heart of the country. When we hear bombs, I'm not sure whether I'm hearing something happening in the next town over, Holon, to the south of me, for example. Towards the beginning of the year, I think some of what I was hearing, as far as I understood it, was actually from Gaza, which had to do with the tremendous, force of Israeli attack there. So I think, you know, everyone's an armchair general in Israel. Everyone's got what to say about exactly how to prosecute the war. So that's, you know, that's just part of it. We've been called an army of generals. Everyone's got something to say. And so it's quite remarkable to see everyone just, you know, before they're even called up to their units, getting up and going. Whether exactly everybody thinks, you know, this is exactly perfect. I mean, it's, how could it be? It's just a massive invasion. The losses since the ground war for Israel, as of today, I believe we're reaching 180 or so, considered very. We haven't. We're watching every night. We watch funerals on the news.
Recording in progress.
Every night we watch funerals on the news, and you hear the letters of soldiers who wrote letters to their families in the event that they were going to be killed, saying, "I went into this knowing this was a just war and a necessary one, and if I have died, very often they say, please." Please live your lives. Don't live in the shadow of my death. Don't live as mourners. And know that I went in willingly, and I'm happy to have made this sacrifice for the country. Now, I will say, those are selective, and where I don't know that there are other letters that exist, but that's what we're hearing. And even parents, you know, sometimes at their children's funeral, you know, the most horrific pain imaginable, equaled only by the pain of the relatives, the parents and children of those who are being kept in torturous conditions inside Gaza. And to hear them say, the parents of a fallen soldier, we are proud, you know, we know this is what he wanted to do. It's something we're hearing quite often. And I don't minimize it. I take it quite seriously.
Well, of course, this is 3 months worth of warfare. Vietnam lasted an eternity, it felt like, for people. And I think at the beginning, there was a sense of patriotism, and then it began to ebb. Before we finish off, I want to ask you to speculate a bit, not about the hearing in The Hague, because as I understand it, the hearing will take place, but then the discussions among the justices will take place for days and days and weeks and months, and a rendering of a decision may not come for a year or more, even if there is a preliminary finding. But speculate a little bit on the question of the political implications of this fighting for the current Israeli government, and especially for that very fragile coalition that holds together for the current prime minister.
I think the big, big question is whether Benjamin Netanyahu would resign. I don't see that as being part of his DNA. He's not somebody that will although the polling shows that he would lose handily to Benny Gantz. So we just don't know whether there's going to be any kind of upheaval. There doesn't seem to be any threat to the coalition, as disgruntled as many coalition members are. They're like now able to talk, feeling comfortable now to talk out against various decisions. There doesn't seem right now to be a credible threat to this coalition in the near future, in the next months. There has started now a protest movement to call for, to call for Netanyahu to step down. There were probably, I don't know, I dropped by the last demonstration, which was last week. There was maybe 1,000 people there, but I don't see it picking up huge steam. Right now, maybe in the next weeks. So I'm not good at, I should say, I'm not very good at predicting politics in this country. I specifically don't think I'm good at it, but I also think they're rather unpredictable here. I should also say that, yeah, exactly. I should also say that the one thing that it depends on is whether those who joined an emergency government will continue to stay. And so far, I think they're sticking with it, but they have signaled that they might leave if they can't, influence some of the more egregious decisions or decisions that they themselves politically find egregious. For example, all kinds of budgeting issues where they didn't feel that the proper steps were taken to deal with the emergencies, and that various ministers held on to budgets that were ridiculous and of no use right now and should have been moved over into much more needy, urgent matters. So they've again also sort of started to make noise about that, but not elevated yet to we're going to leave. They're paving the way for an exit, and that might lead then to elections. But can I say it's just really hard to predict here.
Oh, sure. No. We're speaking with Miriam Herzlag of Times of Israel. This is Brooke Spector in the Deep Dive. We'll be right back after this message.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
We're speaking with Miriam Herzlag of the Times of Israel, and we have just a very short time left. But Miriam, if you want to offer some final observations about the circumstances of the war or the International Court of Justice or its implications on Israeli politics, this is your moment. You've got about a minute to do that.
I would say Israelis are bewildered by the world response when we have such a astounding and abundant evidence of war crimes, of rape. For example, there was a tremendous shock over the inability of global women's movements not to condemn the use of sexual violence in this, which was pervasive and probably rises to the level of an atrocity or a war crime. So Israelis are bewildered by this, and I think it potentially can have lasting effects on our politics and our sense of who we are in the world. And the other big force is the internal solidarity that happened as a result of this. Again, I mentioned that we were a quarrelsome and very divided right before this over the changes in our democratic structure that this government, which is the most right-wing government Israel has ever had, that they were trying to introduce. In the interim, the High Court of Justice basically put a stop to that, and it may be over, but we were really fighting, and we're a very tribal society. We insult each other at tremendous rates between religious and non-religious people and ethnic backgrounds and Jews and Arabs. And we can often be unkind to each other. And after October 7th, I think it's one of the wonders of the world to see what happened in terms of the volunteerism, in terms of the generosity and the self-sacrifice that happened as a result of this, the clarity of thought that happens when we feel threatened. And I can only hope that this will take us forward, the sense of solidarity.
Sadly, we have run out of time and we'll have to say goodbye. This has been our conversation with Miriam Hirschlag, pre-recorded before the International Court of Justice has its hearings on Thursday and Friday. And we will probably have to revisit that in the coming weeks as well. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive. And we'll be back again next week at 9 o'clock on this station.
Thanks for having me.